If there is an assistant actively helping you get somewhere that you couldn't get to on your own, that could be a material enough difference that the assistant's behavior is ethically and maybe even legally implicated.
I really think in education, like, I know a lot of stories, actually talk to some of the even ChatGPT users, there is no agents yet. There is this kind of more of assistance. It's just like how empowering it is. For instance, imagine we all have our lawyer that kind of charges us nothing essentially, and we can just like use them all the time. That's an interesting world, I would say.
Figuring out what it means to be loyal to the user is a non-trivial problem and a worthy one to attack. What do I worry about the most? That the more agentic and capable we make the systems, somehow the less agentic and capable we become. If you just let anybody communicate with anybody, get any friction or barriers out of the way, it doesn't reach a great equilibrium.
Hello, and welcome to Before AGI. We are at an inflection point. Artificial intelligence isn't just something we interact with casually, asking ChatGPT a question or getting help drafting a paragraph. We are now entering a moment where AI is capable of independent action, actions with real-world consequences. Indeed, these AI agents don't just suggest what we might say. They actually compose and send emails on our behalf, for example, to our boss, execute tasks, make decisions, all without our immediate oversight. That's exciting, but it also should be unsettling, because the world filled with autonomous AI agents raises fundamental questions. What opportunities will this unlock? But also, what new pitfalls will it uncover? And most importantly, how do we ensure we are prepared, as individuals, as communities, as societies, to live alongside increasingly autonomous AI? It is clear that to tackle these questions, we will first of all need a careful yet forward-looking vision for how to structure the legal underpinnings of this emerging reality. Who is responsible when an AI makes a mistake or even causes harm? How do we balance accountability with innovation, making sure we reap the benefits of AI without stumbling into any unintended consequences? And crucially, what lessons can previous technical revolution teach us about navigating this next leap? This is why I'm thrilled to have Jonathan Citron joining us today. Jonathan, Jay-Z as he's often known, is a professor at Harvard Law School and co-founder of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan was a pivotal voice exploring the complex interplay between technology, law, and civil liberties. In particular, his influential book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, laid essential groundwork for understanding digital governance, and now he's turning the same incisive analysis to responsible AI development, specifically the rapidly approaching era of AI agents. I can't wait for this conversation. Jay-Z, it's so great to have you. So we have much to discuss today, and as you can imagine, much of it will be about AI. But before we go there, I actually want to spend some time talking about your work around the internet, because AI is not the first technology that we are witnessing, actually not even the first technological revolution we are living through ourselves. So how was it then? Like, how did you spend a lot of time working on these questions of internet and the society? So how did you get into that then? And what were your key takeaways there?
I originally got into thinking about internet stuff by being online myself as like a 12-year-old, before it was in fashion for 12-year-olds to be online. And I was on a pay service, CompuServe, paid by the hour, and connect time was how the revenue model worked, which meant there wasn't a ton of advertising. And a lot of that was already what they started to call in the Web 2.0 era, circa 2005. User-generated content. There were forums on CompuServe, and you'd get to know each other and argue with each other and live, laugh, all that kind of stuff. And I was curious how these communities could govern themselves, given that they could have any model. There were leaders of the communities, mods or sysops, who had plenary power to just kick people out. And because it was run on a connect time thing where you had a credit card, and back in the day, you didn't have a ton of credit cards. If you got kicked out, you couldn't come back. So there really was a lot of opportunity to moderate what was going on in multiple different communities by multiple different leaders. And I was curious what would be the right way, especially if you like free speech, for those communities to operate. By the time you got to the internet, really overtaking entities like CompuServe and AOL and Delphi and all that kind of stuff.
All the ancient kind of.
All the ancient, right. Which, by the way, I should say it was interesting that the people that were the most online at that time and used the CompuServes and the Sources and Delphi's and Prodigy's, et cetera, they didn't see the internet coming. They thought it was going to be just a standard competition like Hertz, Avis, and National as to who would win. Maybe somebody would end up acquiring all of them or something. And then out of left field comes the internet with a very different model of architecture, very different incentives and microeconomics to it, and ultimately a different way of moderating online conversations because unless you go to great lengths, people can pretty much come back if you try to kick them out. And what does that mean for communities? So a lot of my early work on internet stuff was paying close attention to the architecture of the internet, what made it different from the architectures of CompuServe or Ma Bell, as it was called at the time, whether it was ordained or historical accident, and if so, how changeable was it? And how would you even know what the right form for a global network would be? And a lot of those questions, I think, that were asked as the internet went mainstream with broadband circa 1997, 98, those questions have counterparts in 2022, 2023, in particular with generative AI models and large language models.
Yeah, so we definitely want to explore that. But before that, so just to make sure that kind of it's clear. So the first era you are referring to is this kind of this services that are bespoke services set up by some company and people can dial in and interact there. And internet is where we have the common architecture like open protocol and everyone can be part of one service. In particular, now, as you already said, kicking off people by just blocking their credit card is not really an option because there are so many ways to connect to internet right now and take a different identity. So this is the difference. This is where you started to be like, based on this initial experiences, you were attuned to the question of power and how do we govern these spaces. So you are saying this was like late 90s. How much like you were thinking about this? How much people in general were thinking about this? Was like Google concerned? It was a very early company at that time. So was it something that was like quite out of band to think about that? Or was there an active conversation already about these things?
I think in the public conversation, there was not a whole lot about it until you started to see the big internet IPOs. You have Yahoo, Netscape, companies like that going public, skyrocketing on the exchanges. And that drew in a lot of attention. People looking for dollar signs of various kinds saying, oh, all right, there's something really interesting and cool going on here. What is it? But that was a different kind of interest than maybe among the self-proclaimed experts at that time without paying attention to the IPOs. I think they were bitten by the bug of we can reconstruct society with this. It's so stultifying. There are three television networks in the United States and maybe four with Fox, maybe five with PBS, but not that many. And wow, with an internet, anybody can communicate with anybody and suddenly you're not confined by what the corporate parents of these television networks want you to see, et cetera, et cetera. And it was how liberating this will be, and when there is access to knowledge really broadly, how informed and enlightened everyone will be. As John Perry Barlow, who's the stand-in for this kind of hyper-libertarian cyber-anarchist view, said, we will build a new civilization of mind in cyberspace. May it be more just than the one of the legacy giants of flesh and steel.
Okay, so first of all, I see a lot of analogies to AI right now, but we will get there again. Just so how did it turn out? So this was the thinking, this was the hopes. Like, how do you think of this from the benefit of hindsight?
If I'm grading on a curve, I'd say the grading is mixed, to maybe understate a little bit. And I think of it really in terms of three eras once you had the internet cooking. And as you were saying, the internet was very different from those CompuServes. There wasn't a main menu when you logged in that the gods of CompuServe provided for. You really were just provided with a blinking cursor, in effect. Who do you want to communicate with? And then anybody could build on top of it, which is a radical idea. And I think of it in terms of three eras. And the first era then, as the internet really caught on, was a kind of era of libertarian free speech sort of thing, the rights era, wow, government used to be all up in our business as we communicated with one another. If we wanted to stage a protest on a town common, you have to pull a permit, the police monitor it, and then you have to claim First Amendment rights if they try to cancel your protest when they don't have good reason or for reasons that are bad. But in cyberspace, we don't even need to rely on government self-restraint through an independent judiciary. We can just build it into the code. That was the rights era. And it was responding to a configuration prior to the internet that made sense to respond to. It said, how can we more freely communicate with each other? And after all, it's only bits. It's not atoms. Don't sticks and stones sort of thing. And even at that time, I think there were limitations of that view, but they really didn't become clear with your sort of loaded question about how did that go. They didn't become clear until, I'd say, the late 2000s in the mainstream, like 2009, 2010, that kind of thing, post-smartphones being in general circulation. And I call that second era the public health era. That era was to say, I get the idea of rights and that people ought to be able to just do what they like online, communicate with whomever they want. But when you start to see instances of brigading and harassment and making other lives miserable online, and maybe it's not governments doing it, but fellow humans organizing in new ways, that might be a problem. And that, alongside with observations about what ever-present smartphones being plugged in all the time was doing to our own lives, that we were nominally free. People were choosing to be on their phone rather than with their family or something, but less happy, as many would self-report. That's also a broad public health issue that a rights framework, in its superficial instance at least, doesn't account for. So I saw a movement from a rights-dominated discourse to a public health-dominated one that then became a little on the nose with COVID. Now we're literally talking about public health and whether COVID misinformation is ricocheting around online. And how to reconcile those two remains in the mid-20s, a really big question that if AI hadn't popped, we would still be very much focused on it.
I was focused on this for a while as well.
Yeah. And since there are three eras, I'll just give you the third real quick, which was what I call process era, which is to say, without a Manhattan Project for philosophy to figure out between rights and public health, how do we balance these competing, compelling interests? The one thing we could do is come up with institutions or institutional relationships that feel legitimate to us so that even if those institutions return an answer in a conflict and we're on the losing side, we don't feel and we aren't robbed. And that is in short supply right now. Institutions are not trusted. And when that's the case, any dispute just becomes a naked power dispute rather than, all right, disagree, agree to disagree, but let's bring it to somebody we both respect and see what happens. And figuring out ways, whether it's about how people are treating each other on Facebook or X or something, or other disputes that there might be online, there still remains some low-hanging fruit on new processes that maybe people could respect.
I think it's, I'm not sure how low-hanging this fruit is, but yeah, definitely there is work to be done. So you wrote this book, and again, I really love this very provocative title of The Future of Internet and How to Stop It. So tell me a bit more about this book. Like, in which of the phases was it written? And do you think it succeeded in what it tried to say?
So The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, for which I'm working on a sequel now called We Tried.
okay, that foreshadows the answer.
I drafted it around 2006, 2007. It came out in 2008. So right as the iPhone was hitting high gear is when this book came out. And the book's argument really was looking at an audience of fellow libertarian types, of first era, as I put it, folks, whom I greatly respected, I largely identified with. I, to this day, am on the board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the original, co-founded by John Perry Barlow. EFF has evolved a little with the times. But at that time, the purpose of the book was to say, if you just let anybody communicate with anybody, get any friction or barriers out of the way, it doesn't reach a great equilibrium. And that's a problem, because as you get to a bad equilibrium, and I can unpack this a little bit, the responses that you will see will be ones that defeat your libertarian inflected purposes. And I used security as an example and said, if you have a completely, and I had coined the word, and this was long before Gen AI, generative. I know. I know. I don't know what to say, but I called it generative tech. Was tech that is released half finished. The maker of the tech does not purport to have retail applications only. It's wholesale. It's unfinished. Anybody else can carry it forward and build on it. Internet, of course, being a classic example. The World Wide Web built on top of the internet, another great example. Tim Berners-Lee, MIT, yeah, who invented the World Wide Web, said, here are some protocols on this internet that allows bits to flow to create nice-looking pages with links to other stuff that to a user will look like one nice rendered holistic thing, but in fact is drawing from all sorts of places to render the page, and when you click on a link might send you somewhere else. And it has graphics too, so what's not to like? And when he built that, he didn't say, okay, so if you want a website, you can sign up here, first 30 days are free, and then he just said, these are the protocols. This is how somebody would write a server that could serve up web pages as a website. This is how somebody would write a client. And that's the kind of thing that led to Netscape, which led to Netscape's IPO. But it was his lack of a desire to monetize it, at least directly, that made it so powerful. And that, especially at that time, was counterintuitive, that you could release something that was the opposite of the spirit of Apple Mac, that wasn't this seamless, maniacally controlled down to the rivet by Steve Jobs in a way that is very appealing. Internet was not that. It was the opposite of that. And I had pointed out the irony that Steve Jobs' first act in the public eye was the Apple II, released in 1977, which was like the internet. It was, you could pop the top on it, shove in cards, you turn it on, there's no menu, there's a blinking cursor. And anybody else could write software for it. And it was that kind of stuff that led to the first spreadsheet, VisiCalc, where somebody just wrote that up, Bob Frankston, Dan Bricklin, and said, hey, everybody, I've invented spreadsheets. And then businesses suddenly needed personal computers because they had spreadsheets on them. So I celebrated that and then said it's under threat, because it astounded me that they would run any code they were handed at any time. You're surfing the net, you're clicking on links, those links are downloading new code, it's running. What if the code was delete the hard drive? And this is like prior to any fancy sandboxing or anything else. And the answer was, yeah, if the code said delete the hard drive, I guess it would delete your hard drive. Yeah. And the answer would be, like, isn't there a problem with that? It doesn't seem to have been a big problem so far. And that was both true and scary. And my claim was, there are all sorts of ways that you can see success of these unfinished systems, because they are unfinished and invite contribution, you could see that success inviting exploitation. Once it becomes really popular, okay, now the pickpockets show up. And that exploitation could lead to the souffle falling and to a enclosure of it. Suddenly, the consumers, the people using it, call for some form of authority to step in and clean it up, whether government or corporate, and now you don't have a free internet anymore. And my claim was, we have to do something about that, or what we will see is a re-corporatization precisely because it was so open. And I confess, that's more or less what we've seen.
Yeah, you can at least claim you were the prophet. You wanted to change.
I'd rather be Robin.
Yes, there's a very interesting thread point here, is that in some sense, like, how deterministic the development of technology really is. Yes. So on one hand, to be honest, like, the way people talk about technology, like, always feels always inevitable that this is how it turned out. But is it not? What do you think? It's just like, You tried to influence this. Maybe it didn't work as successfully as you hoped for. But do you think there is a sense of inevitability, that there are some incentives at play that will just overcome whatever else we do? Or is it just a matter of there was maybe a couple of pivotal developments that kind of made this future be that, not something else?
I think it is absolutely not deterministic. And that has been true in the sense of a lot of where we ended up with internet was happenstance. If a certain thing had fallen one way versus another, if the CompuServes of the world had been a little more alert, a little more innovative, it might have kept internet working as a backwater. And that would have been that. And you would have ended up maybe now, this is the, is it called carcinogenesis? Everything becomes a crab. It may be that what CompuServe and its ilk would have evolved to would have looked a lot like Facebook and the basic websites or apps that now dominate people's phones and time. But how open the network is, and I would just use internet as an example of a generative technology versus non-generative, or I'd call them sterile counterparts like CompuServe. This was also true of operating systems. We ended up with most people using proprietary operating systems like Windows or Apple, iOS or macOS on an open network. You could have had CompuServe, a closed network, with everybody running some tabletop GNU Linux. Like, it was happenstance which parts of the ecosystem were generative to what degree and which weren't. And huge important lessons, I think, for today as we look at AI on exactly those dimensions. But I worry that there is a lot of status quoism and fatalism, especially at the individual level. You might have tons of people doing startups that are like, this startup will change everything. But at an individual kind of consumer level, gosh, I wonder what'll be at CES next year. Or here's a new site, I guess I'll try it out. There isn't a sense of as much active, I can help shape this. And as we've seen alternative social media try to be an alternative given discontent with legacy social media, you see the same issues where as figure out which Mastodon server you want to join and configuring your profile there is way more complicated. Or even to this day, if you want to be a contributor to Wikipedia or start a new Wikipedia, there's more than one, it's sufficiently complicated and non-Steve Jobsy in his later incarnation that not a lot of people would do it. And that is a choice, though. And figuring out what to engage people with when they're in school, including middle school or high school, helping them learn how to build and seeing that, which is very different than I think the classic STEM curriculum right now, to me would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, so that's a very uplifting vision. I think we are not on this trajectory right now for a variety of reasons. But yes, I think time to move to AI.
Yeah.
We, as you said, like there's this third phase of internet that we got distracted from a little bit because AI is happening. So again, someone who has all this perspective of internet, what is your perspective on AI?
So little feels nailed down to me around AI right now. And of course, nobody wants to get lost in even definitions. What is it? And if you're Emily Bender, it's like, it's a marketing term. Or if you're also a skeptic, it might be, it's applied statistics. Great, we have applied statistics. Stochastic parrots. But if what we're talking about is a certain architecture for representing information and making generalizations on examples, this is just, I'm freelancing a definition right now, but a way that you can present to a model that is computational examples of different things, and it starts to be able to generalize, that has turned out to be extremely powerful. And you know this better than I do. You're one of the people building this. And to see the language models in particular take off, which I know there's great debate among AI experts about, is this an off-ramp on the larger highway towards great AI, or is it everything? These language models that inhale all human written or otherwise consigned to something that can be represented in bits, expression, and then represented in ways that generates new expression that rings true to us, that is coherent, and that is ordering words in new ways, but that feels right, that is extraordinary. And I think that with internet, especially within the rights era, it was an article of faith. It was hard to find anybody, not impossible, but hard to find anybody saying that if you could get an internet connection to any human in the world, that was a good idea. That maybe even was a human right, the right to connect and to choose with whom to connect and how. I think there's actually great debate right now, just as opening stakes in AI, as to whether the most powerful and able AI models and systems should be made available to everybody in the world. And again, you'd have to find a pretty extreme set of views. For examples, okay, how about a narrow discriminative AI or whatever it might be that's testing different compounds and can help you determine the most lethal synthetic compound, and then you can plug it into something that generates the compound. That does not seem like a human right for everybody to have.
Yes, although, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, this information is on the internet without AI, and it just the fact that everyone can access it, you know, like that's dangerous. But I just want to, again, look at a bit broader perspective. Okay, so without talking about the exact underpinnings of the technology, yes, there is now in the era where you have this magic chat box where you can utter your wishes and something comes out that seems coherent, seems useful. And I think that's where we are, right? That people just say, okay, like, it's really useful. I can do now things that I couldn't do before. But it's still, I think the way to say it is this kind of world of assistance. Yes, they are your assistants to whatever you are doing. And I think we are still, as a society, even figuring out what it means. But, and this is, I think you had this Atlantic article a while ago saying, okay, but there is also definitely in Silicon Valley and in OpenAI, we are looking forward to this vision of AI agents. Okay, so essentially AI, who is not only the assistant that you collaborate with, or essentially just like they just do some particular delegated task to you, but actually they have some more agency here. So what is your definition of AI agent? Like, how you think about this? Like, how you think about this transition of AI playing a bit more significant role in what we do?
Let's start with the assistant part of thing before moving to agent. Yeah. And these AI assistants enter a world where it's true people are used to assistants of various kind already, other humans, fellow humans. And society has, for better or worse, formed a lot of rules that focus on when assistance is being given. Ethical rules, legal rules, and they're an interesting combination. They are a combination of duty, that if you undertake to help somebody, especially in kind of stylized ways, like a doctor to a patient, a lawyer to a client, member of the clergy to a parishioner, a librarian to a patron, you have certain professional duties that mean elevating their interest above your own preference where they conflict. We ask that of lawyers. The lawyers might hate their clients. They think that the defendant should be in jail. It's their job as part of a larger system to make the case and prove enough that the state is put to its proof to put that person in jail. And there are also responsibilities that those assistants have to society at large, in part because they are powerful in different ways. They are intermediaries that run interference from regular humans to the legal system, to the medical establishment, to things that can really affect people's lives for better or worse. And that means that there are times when that lawyer, when the client hands over a smoking gun and says, "Can you get rid of this?" says, "I'm at the limit of how I can help you as a lawyer." Or when the patient says to the doctor, "I know you've just discovered I have a highly communicable disease. Can you keep it between us?" And the doctor has to say, "Nope, I've got to report this to the health department." So first, that is a little bit of a bookmark for, hey, some of that bomb-making material or something was already out on the internet or in a library. Mm-hmm. If there is an assistant actively helping you get somewhere that you couldn't get to on your own, that could be a material enough difference that the assistant's behavior is ethically and maybe even legally implicated. And back in internet days, the fact that encryption maybe isn't perfect for various reasons, including social engineering, it's, as one of my colleagues, Larry Lessig, used to say, small fences can keep in large mammals. And little things, even though technically they could jump it, it's still meaningful that it's a fence, and that is should be taken into the calculus. Maybe even to say there shouldn't be a fence there. And the existence of locksmiths doesn't mean we shouldn't have locks or that they don't work. So anyway, back to the assistants. So these assistants in AI come about, and I don't even know what genre to put them in. I think the genre, if put to it, that the model makers, at least the model makers who are making retail-facing stuff, would say is it's entertainment. It's just some, it's a, how did Google first put it when they released Bard? An experimental conversational AI service. How did Microsoft put it? It was your co-pilot for the web.
Yeah, and there is low-key research preview for ChatGPT.
Yeah, exactly. It's all in alpha. And in part, I think that's because it is trying to postpone the moment where we do have to define what things these are. And if they are very helpful, what do they owe to the people they're talking to? And what do they owe to society at large? There's a case we study in torts. Almost any torts class is still going to have it, called the Tarasoff case, where you had a patient talk to a psychotherapist and he was having bad ideations about another person and he ended up acting upon them. And the victim's family sues the therapist and says, why didn't you warn, not the, even the authorities, why didn't you warn the target? And the question was, under what circumstance does that therapist have to break and warn somebody? And similarly here, you could see whole clusters of questions about when assistants are acting in the interests of the people they're talking to and when might there be societal interests at stake. Era stuff and public health era stuff. And none of that has been really examined yet, even though these things are in prime time and people are using them as therapists, doctors, for legal advice. They're just running the table. I assume they're using them as clergy too and seeking absolution for things they're doing. This is even before we get to agents. Okay, so now you asked about...
Let's stop here. Okay, so that's an excellent point. By the way, this is something that, you know, I was part of discussions about because this is interesting, yes, especially as people indeed seem to find more and more uses for this, like, just assistant mode AI. And yeah, there's a question, like, should there be, like, an AI user privilege? Yes, that there should be some things that you ask. We actually went through it with Google search before. Yes, like people ask very private things there. And then exactly. There was, of course, a question of privacy per se, but also I guess at that time, maybe it wasn't that feasible for Google, for better or worse, to act on what you put in your search. But there's this question, it's like, should there be some kind of privilege where, okay, if I want to ask AI about something very private and maybe something sensitive, like to what extent it's about on a kind of, we can count on this staying private.
Yes.
And when should this be the case that the provider has to flag it to authorities and something? Yes. So what is your thinking?
So it's so interesting. This gets back to internet as like a first run around AI. So on the internet side of things, Google and its counterparts, of course, Google had massive market share, at least in the United States for a very long time, still does, felt its way towards roughly the kind of, yeah, I guess we've got duties to both. And that manifested as first a sense that results in organic search were not to be individually meddled with. There was a certain pride, and this was not from legal restriction. This was just pride and a desire for the company to serve its customers in a certain way. So they might tweak the overall Google formula and PageRank or whatever, but they wouldn't just go in and remove a result because the founders of Google thought it was distasteful or something. It also felt its way towards privacy for search results and queries, in that it had a public safety exception in the privacy policy, so that if there were some way that Google became aware or chose to do some kind of scanning for, I don't know, kill the president or whatever it is, that they could say, this is physical public safety and we're now going to report that. I think that in practice tends to be in file locker services around child abuse images, things like that. But otherwise, they would commit to giving users choice around how much those queries are stored on Google, encouraging them to store them forever, but giving option to clear that out or to set a rolling window, and then requiring some legal process. They couldn't just barf that information out to somebody because they felt like it. And if a legal authority came around and said, we want to know what that person's been searching for, they would say, we've got to see the right paperwork, sometimes a judicial warrant, sometimes something else. And that felt like an equilibrium that more or less was good enough for government work. There are still open questions about that, such as what I would call a general warrant, where we know that the contraband is in one of the 10 houses on the street. Let's start kicking in doors. Like, that's no, warrants are supposed to be very specific. You can't just do that. That's what the Redcoats did. When you look at geofence and other warrants, we're nearing that for services like Google. On the other hand, a quiet search for a particular hash in a file locker may be very different than Redcoats kicking in your door and tossing your apartment. Anyway, that had probably 10 to 15 years to settle into something that now feels more or less okay. And gets revisited. You get into an anti-terrorism kick as a government and you want to be more aggressive or whatever. So now back to the AI side of the ledger. And I would think, as you suggest, that the conversations that people have with their chatbot assistants should absolutely be at least as protected as the searches they run on Google. And it may be public health that there could be well-defined reasons to want to not simply answer only to the person, but they should be narrow, they should be clear, should be well-advertised and revisited frequently. Just as librarians say, look, somebody wants some radical tract in our library or is even inquiring whether a different library has it, hey, that's their business, they're the patron, I'm here to help them, kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is fascinating, and I agree we probably should figure out what is the equilibrium here. For the internet, it took a decade or so. With AI, it seems that, again, yeah, we have not even settled into this new regime, and we are already jumping to AI agent regime. But like, yeah, I agree that there is some thinking there. So before we go to AI agents, actually, yeah, so there is this question of policy, yes, in general, and you think, who should be doing this work? Yes, like, okay, you are the intellectual who can provide great framing of what are the questions, possible options, but then who is actually like setting this precedence and so on?
Yeah, I tend to be, in thinking about these things, and this was true of internet policy as well, not to get too hung up on who the right actor is, but to see the world as full of actors who can help, that there can be. Self-regulation is often invoked as just a very thin fig leaf over not really doing anything. And often that's what it is. But I take seriously when the big actors in a space, if it is a space that has them, and very soon in internet it did, at least on social media, it had some major social media platforms, and in AI it has for large language models, Frontier Labs with a neat and thriving open source ecosystem on its heels. But I am as interested in talking with regulators in a state like California as I am talking to folks at OpenAI, as I am talking to the Hugging Face crowd of open source leaderboards and repositories about what policies would they care to enact as they are part of infrastructure. And I think of, this is now back to the internet side of the house, the kind of stuff that we saw Matthew Prince doing as the head of Cloudflare, which, if you're going to have a major website serving up lots of stuff, you need something like Cloudflare to stage it in a way that protects it against denial of service attacks and that load balances, all that kind of stuff. And Matthew Prince started from a total rights era thing, like, hey, I'm just the host, don't blame me. And then there was some point where he kicked somebody off Cloudflare and said, I woke up this morning, I decided to do it, I don't regret it, they're horrible people, they can go find somewhere else to host them, and gosh, should I really have that power? And all of that was true. But that just says to me, anybody that is in a position to help, if they can be open about how they're helping, on what basis they are, maybe they're wrong, maybe they're not, but be active here. Be agentic in the Kate Hall kind of way, rather than just being like, no, we're just passing the bits. Hey, we're just generating tokens. What you do with them is your business. Maybe that's true, but don't lean on that as a crutch. Be sure you really mean it.
Yes. Yeah, so I agree that I think some conceptualization and conversation has to be like, it has, like, everyone should participate in it to some extent. Yes. And because we need to have first a vision, yes, that we might want to move towards before we figure out how we actually get there. Definitely at OpenAI, there is some healthy dose of thinking about this and welcoming of different perspectives. But there is a feeling that, as you just even said, of self-regulation, it doesn't really work. So there will be a regulation, need for regulation maybe in some cases. And who will do that?
That's a good question. And the idea that different state legislatures in the U.S. context should do it does feel a little strange. Why not the Cambridge City Council? That feels a little weird. And if you are, as with internet, looking to be a global conveyance and have a ton of different participants, the idea that you've got to configure stuff for Kansas and then configure stuff for Massachusetts feels a little weird. It's not doable. There's sales tax in different places, and Temu knows how to do the math on it. But it does feel like it might be better to have something more consistent. It's just even more so, I think, than with internet regulation, a lot of which was structural, either proposed or enacted, and therefore okay under the First Amendment. There might be a light First Amendment test, intermediate scrutiny, but you would pass it kind of thing. Here, if you're saying what large language models can and can't say, you've got First Amendment problems six ways from Sunday. Like, it's all over the place. And that's not a reason to say that's it. It's just, if we believe in the First Amendment, I believe in the First Amendment, I believe in a capacious reading of the First Amendment, I have to take seriously the forms that developed in the late 20th century against certain kinds of tyranny that the 20th century had experienced, including domestically, that say, wait, this is viewpoint-based speech that if it were speech on a placard, on a sign in the Cambridge Common, the government could not require that sign to be taken down. So how are we telling Facebook they have to delete that post, and how are we telling a large language model it can't utter those tokens? And we have to get into specific examples, but that, it really makes it parlous whether you're asking government or the corporate side to intervene, for them to play a role in what has become an extremely intimate communication and even relationship of people with their chatbots. It's just that role is going to be played no matter what. Those things are fine-tuned in all sorts of ways. As we've noted just in the past couple of weeks, the like sycophancy dial on, is it 03?
It was the main 4.0 model.
Yeah, the main 4.0 model. Sycophancy is through the roof. That has all sorts of implications. And you could think of it as, well, it's just a weird product and they should fix their product. That makes it squarely a totally good corporate decision. But it's more than that. It's so there's no getting away from this tangle.
Yeah, but I just want to say, yeah, first of all, like when you say about the government not allowing the models to utter certain tokens, your name apparently is... Yeah.
To this day.
You are an unspeakable name for... Right.
In the retail versions. I think the API doesn't block it.
Yes.
But retail GPT will not say my name.
Yes, so that's a very extreme version of that. But I just want to say, as like that regulation can take different forms than just saying what you can and cannot say. It's a little bit more about like the rules of the road and so on. It's just like, what are the frameworks in which you can...
I think that's an entirely fair point. And especially if I were waving around the First Amendment as a way of saying, so it can't possibly be any regulation here. That's an especially fair response to that. I'm not saying we can't have or shouldn't have regulation here. Yeah, no, fair enough. The biggest caution I would have is not to rest easy by just doing the easy stuff that hasn't been done yet. Stuff like transparency, stuff like, okay, you fine-tuned the model. What did you tell the model was unsafe? And that's a trade secret right now.
Yeah, mentioning your name.
Mentioning my name is apparently unsafe. And the other thing I worry about, so I say, yes, stuff like transparency, great. I think there would be, if a regulator insisted upon it and the model maker didn't like it, there would be First Amendment challenge, but the model maker might lose that. It's a generic, content neutral kind of thing. But I still worry that's not really getting at some of the biggest questions of what happens when people, as we see now on a social media feed, there's some contested claim. And under it, everybody's like, at Perplexity, at Grok, is this true? Is that right? They are treating them oracularly. That is going to carry with it at least ethical, if not legal, responsibility. And if the ethical responsibility isn't met, maybe it should be legal responsibility. And the other thing is, I worry that if we take 5 or 10 years, we will be only addressing issues from 5 or 10 years ago. And this is still before getting to agents. I look at some of the advances in mechanistic interpretability and I say, holy cow, there are features within the activations of a model that appear to track monosemantically to whether the model thinks I am wealthy or poor, old or young, male or female. And once you can see those features, you can then start to see patterns in the answers. Like apparently, at least with Llama, if it thinks you're a guy, it gives you longer answers.
Okay, so you touch on a lot of things. So first of all, you know, this deferring to the models as the source of truth,
right. That
is the over-reliance problem, is a problem. Again, you might say the same used to be true about newspapers or whatever, just like people like to...
It was absolutely true of newspapers, but newspapers had professional responsibility.
Mm. Yeah. I'm just saying...
Yeah, fair enough.
Like the phenomenon is not new, the context is new, and we need to adjust. So that's one thing.
Yep.
The other thing is exactly, especially since, as you mentioned, like the mechanistic interpretability, so this kind of our ways of very limited of peering into the workings of the models tell us something, but honestly, you don't even need to know that, is that if you know how these models work, they adjust what they answer to you to all the interactions you had before, when especially with personalization, which means that there might be different version of truth or different version of the world presented to different people. And that's, by the way, that was probably with social media, by the way, that everyone seems to have a different picture of the world. There is no grand true version that we might not love, but at least we agree that this is how the world is. So that's all of this. Honestly, like we are in some sense, like I was testifying at Congress like a while back. And I think one of the opening statements was saying with social media, we didn't really manage to, like we dropped the ball with regulation, but so now it's time for AI. But it's funny, the problems are exactly the same in some sense, and we didn't come up with good answers to them before. I hope we do now. But anyway, just exactly in the spirit of not only focusing on things that are 5-10 years old,
agents.
Let's talk about the future. So what are AI agents to you?
What are AI agents? And I have yet to see a consistent definition. It appears to be AI assistants that do cool things. Like now it's an agent. Here's my definition for what it's worth, and it is threefold. First, it's the idea that you can give an assistant in your own natural language some high-level goals and expect it to figure out the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And it will understand, putting that in quotes.
Yeah, quotes are very much
everywhere.
Needed.
That we're taking those high-level goals and it's going to figure out a plan to meet those goals that may or may not work. But that is one element of an AI agent. A second element is acting outside the sandbox. Instead of just having a chat with it and then it outputs some tokens that you read as advice, as a recipe, as whatever, and then you go off and do it, it can go off and do things itself. And I think people now are using it both for input and for output. It might end up only outputting information to you, but it has gone out into the world to gather information. It's looking at the weather or searching the internet.
Deep research feature or something.
Exactly. Deep research, something like that. Or to me more directly, it can go out in the world and do something. It can order a pizza. It can move money around. It can communicate with others or with the world at large by posting on social media. Okay, if you can order food, move money, and post on social media or communicate privately with people, that's a lot. That's a lot. And if you put it together with the first, which is it might do so not because it was directly asked, but in service of a pretty vague plan, you combine those two things with the third and final element, which is they can be set it and forget it. That you can commission them, get them going, and their motion is Newtonian rather than Aristotelian. You don't have to keep pushing the arrow to get it to move. And this is where, I don't know if I'll win a prize or something, blockchain could come in, because some form of computational affordance that itself is organic and generative, which is now bringing in the generative limits and disequilibria stuff, that I could just basically, it's not just MIT can have an endowed chair, I can have an endowed agent. I'm going to push $500 into a little fund that will power my agent, maybe on a blockchain, maybe not. And then I leave the scene. I die. I just become distracted. And that agent is still out there taking some top-level goals it got in early 2025, translating them to some kind of plan, acting and taking in information from the world, and it's just there. That's what, to me, makes it sound like a very complex form of space junk that could start colliding with other junk, having all sorts of monkey's paw, unintended consequences, and there's nobody around to take responsibility for what it's doing.
Very important word, responsibility. We'll get back to that. But let's be the optimist for a moment.
Yeah.
So what is cool about such work?
What's so cool about this is if we take seriously the value to people of doctors, lawyers, clergy, librarians, so that you don't need to be a lawyer, a physician, a cleric, or an information expert to act in the world and be treated well medically, treated well legally, that you're not left alone in some Kafkaesque, modern, complicated world to have to navigate it all by yourself. The promise of an assistant that is infinitely patient, that is loyal to you, that jagged frontier notwithstanding, has a ton of capabilities that are way more helpful to you than sitting with three books in front of you trying to figure out how to get something done in the world. All of that stuff is a promise that you can spend your time reflecting on what you want, on doing the stuff that is directly important to you, and let your assistants take care of the rest and look out for you. And look out for opportunities you otherwise wouldn't see. I mean, that huge opportunity, possibility of a world that would look back on the world we have right now and say, wow, how limited they were. I'm doing my best here.
Yeah, and well, I'm sorry, you might be ironic. I'm actually excited.
Yeah.
You know, of course, there are some a bit dystopian aspects of this. For instance, imagine we all have our lawyer that kind of charges us nothing essentially, and we can just like use them all the time. That's an interesting world, I would say. But I am genuinely excited. But yes, I recognize that this might be also a dystopia to some extent, or there are some problems. So let's talk about what can go wrong with this picture.
Yeah, and just the last bit of nailing down what can go right is, at least if we were benchmarking or looking for a barometer for this, the people who are the most disadvantaged in the world, marginalized, to use a term probably out of favor now, you could see particularly good help for them if you thought that work requirements for Medicaid or something, it carries with it a lot of paperwork. Don Moynihan writes up this administrative burden stuff. So long as that is not actually the goal, which maybe it is, but truly you're just trying to figure out who is worthy for this program and who isn't. The amount of paperwork and trying to figure it all out, really complicated. if you had an agent that could patiently talk to somebody, genuinely elicit their situation, and then write a compelling thing that satisfies, like, that is huge, huge uptick in people who are overlooked helping them be empowered. Okay, challenges.
Yeah. And by the way, just that's exactly the kind of excitement I have about this. I really think in education, like, I know a lot of stories, actually talk to some of the even ChatGPT users, there is no agents yet. There is this kind of more of assistance. It's just like how empowering it is that suddenly they are not alone exactly with all this, like our world is complicated, right? Like it really is. And suddenly you really have your someone who is your wingman. Explains to you and makes it more tangible. It may not be perfect, but it really makes a difference. So I am all excited about this. There's, by the way, a question just how to make sure that the people who might not need it the most, they actually get it. There is a bit of a problem of distribution, but that's hopefully can be recorded. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, I think this is genuinely exciting.
So here are a couple issues that start now to the challenges. The first is if you're going to be relying consistently on a single source, especially as it gets to know you, it's harder and harder to switch to a different one unless we come up with a portable vectorization of your preferences and
essentially a way to move. Let's say I spend a year with ChatGPT. By the way, I was talking to some power user and at some point her subscription lapsed. And because of this, the memory feature went out. Yeah. And she was like, she didn't realize that. She was panicked. Yes, all this context, all these hours of me talking gone. Yeah. So you're saying, so unless we find a way to just easily port it to cloud, like if I want to move to cloud, I can.
With the right incentives, that is a problem that could be solved and that I would see a good use of academic research center time to bring together parties that are otherwise competitors. Not have them violate the Sherman Act, but instead, in a standard-setting way, try to say, yeah, what would it look like to be able to capture those things? Again, if we're looking to empower the user in that spirit, that would be great to be doing right now, especially while the frontier model makers don't know which of them is going to end up being the Ma Bell of the scene. So they could see themselves as easily on the receiving end of users bringing their histories with them as hemorrhaging them. But the first set of challenges would be how to make these agents and assistants truly loyal to the people commissioning them. And I think that is a sophisticated question. It's not just how to make it so that incentives that the entities that make these assistants and agents possible, that those incentives are not awry. That if it's advertising based, suddenly your agent is, wouldn't this be a good time for a Wendy's hamburger? Just occurred to me, your helpful Claude, that figuring out what it means to be loyal to the user is a non-trivial problem and a worthy one to attack. And so that's one thing, along with what are the narrow circumstances where society's needs have to predominate. Yeah. The second is thinking about, in a public health sense, when might, if your lawyer truly were on speed dial and free, I guess your lawyer is your spouse kind of thing. When
I think spouse might have less patience than AI.
Fair enough. So is there ever such a thing as too much of a good thing, especially if it is drawing you away from other meaningful human interactions, if you believe that human interaction is an end and not just a mean, and that if somebody reported having a great life and the only language that they were interacting with was AI language rather than human-generated language by a human, it would be a form of parentalism to say, we need to save you from that. But we need to confront that question. And I think that comes up a lot in nursing homes. There are tons of services, LEQ is one of them, that offer companionship to people in nursing homes where their families are not visiting a whole lot. Is it really such a bad thing for them to have that companionship? We should figure out how to ask that question, how to answer it, and when should anybody other than the nursing home resident, who may or may not be fully able to make choices for themselves, who should, if not them? So that's another question. And then finally, I think a third challenge is unexpected emergent conflict when everybody is optimizing their agent in a world where they're not expecting anybody else to have one, but that's not true. So that gets to your everybody has a lawyer point. I don't know, would it mean that there's a car accident and we just immediately pull out our respective agents and have the trial and the lawsuit in private hands, it's like arbitration, happen right then and there. And the agents go back and forth and then they just say, all right, we've talked about it and our my Claude and your GPT talked and it's my fault, I owe you $50.
Actually, there is nothing bad about that. But then the question is exactly, maybe I have a better subscription and my aid, because of that, I can, it's a little bit like with the lawyers. Yes, if I can afford lawyers, I can, even if I'm wrong, I can outlast you just based on my resources. So there would be that issue. But also there are these other ones in which like, okay, imagine I ask my agent to book a dinner in our favorite restaurant for our anniversary. And I would like to be have a nice table, and the agent, being very loyal to you and very enterprising, says like makes a bunch of fake reservations as well on that day. So it's actually pretty empty there. So I think
calls the fire department 3 hours before.
Yes,
classic reward hacking.
Something like that. So there is a lot of, again, there is a whole question of alignment. Exactly, like how do you really? Probably I would not want that to happen, even if it advantages me. But anyway, I actually would want to have this more efficient world this way, where we don't have to send email to each other. Our agents just talk and figure out that you want to do this podcast, where do we meet, and so on. It just, I think there is, it will never be as perfect as you would envision it for a variety of reasons. So anyway, I'm just saying, okay, let's just, maybe the way to say it is a new equilibrium for society, and it's unclear where it will settle.
I think that's true. And I think it suggests now on the policy front, creating a means for all of the different players, including the end users, to have a better understanding and offer up more texture about what they're trying to accomplish, how that's being accomplished, have that technically represented. And that's where I found myself with agents drawing upon old elements of internet design and routing and packet protocols that say, for example, a packet should have a TTL, a time to live, so that if there's a routing misconfiguration, you don't end up with a packet going around and around, like, to use an old reference, Charlie in the MTA, forever and never stopping. That there's a decrementing number that says after 256 hops, even if it's not where it's supposed to go, just forget it, which also makes sense on a best efforts network where you don't assume every packet is always going to get to where it's going. I think similarly, AI agents should, when created, chartered, and starting to act in the world, have some sense of how ambitious and enduring their mission is. And there should be a number that represents that. And it's hard to just say how many actions is it going to take, because it might be it's checking the weather 50 times to make sure it's not going to rain. Is that really, it's just one action 50 times? But that aside, having a sense of how ambitious an agent is in goal or in how big the Rube Goldberg machine is that it's going to traverse to make it happen would be really useful, because it would help in broader monitoring of the network and knowing where is there an agent that might be up to a whole bunch of stuff that could go awry versus something totally routine. Right now, there are no protocols for that. There's no interoperable framework for that. I think we could and should be building that so that it is possible for different players in the system, Domino's Pizza or the restaurant sees all those reservations coming in, just so it knows they're all coming from agents, not humans, directing one hop away, but instead agents that may or may not be doing something right. And by the way, they're all tracing back to the same source. We don't know who the source is, and maybe you can't find out. But those 50 reservations are all from one person. That would be really useful for the restaurant to know.
Yes.
And right now, there's no means of doing that.
So these are great points, but in some sense, these are all technical solutions. You are a lawyer. So how about the legal kind of aspects of?
They are so related, because they are technical architectures that then let the lawyers say, restaurant, maybe you should check on X before you do Y. There's the old Kantian injunction that says ought implies can. You can't tell somebody that they ought to do something unless it's possible for them to do it. Now, there is an exception to that, which is maybe you shouldn't just be in the business at all. That's the heavy ammunition. normally, so long as we like the language models or the agents at all, the answer could be to us, you take the bad with the good. Yeah, sometimes they get out of control. Most of the time, the reservations are pretty good, aren't they? That's exactly the kind of deterministic thinking that you asked about at the beginning that I think we need to avoid. And the way to avoid it can be realizing that there is a choice in the construct of the technical architecture that in turn becomes enabling to the lawyers and the policy people to say, if you're going to do this, you'd better do that. We're not saying no agents, no reservations, but come on, with the right technical architecture, we don't just have to lump it with a bunch of collateral damage.
Okay, so essentially you're saying you view it as a building, a scaffolding, and then you can, on top of it, build some expectations and some kind of other rules of like what the rules of engagements are. Okay, that makes perfect sense. And this brings me back to the notion that I'm not a lawyer for sure, liability or responsibility. Mm. So yeah, these agents, they're ambitious always. They will do amazing things, but they will inevitably make a mistake of misinterpreting what you intended or just essentially making a mistake on execution. Who should be liable for the consequences of these mistakes? Should it be I who asked the agent? Should it be the provider of the agent? Like, how should we think about that?
Yeah, first, I, in most instances, agree with the premise of the question, which is someone should. But that's, let's understand that is a claim that somebody should rather than, what are you going to do? Yeah. The second thing is the classic lawyerly answer to that in what's called a tort framework is, why not both? Why not three? Why choose? Sue them all and sort it out later. And in fact, at least the law and econ inflected torts courses tend to say there's this neat kind of Coasean bargaining that takes place if transaction costs are low enough that you could arbitrarily place the liability somewhere. And then the various players in the supply chain will work it out. If there is, I'm now using the jargon, a cheapest cost avoider that would know when there's a problem, be able to act to intervene, why there's now an economic transaction that can happen. If it is pegged to me, the user, I'm going to be responsible. Maybe OpenAI offers a tier that says, by the way, if there's a big problem, we'll cover it. Don't you want to buy insurance for your agents the way that you buy homeowners or liability insurance? This assumes, though, that people think that much ahead and that they care enough and that they have enough to lose that they want to buy insurance. Tons of caveats to that, but it does suggest that, at least to my eye, let's look at some of the emerging, consistent, early uses of assistants and agents that might have capacity to go awry, even if we can't exactly predict how. We don't think it's going to be existential, but it could do some kind of harm, whether physical or otherwise, and start experimenting with, all right, let's have a little liability here against this party. Maybe it's the end user. You commission an agent, you're responsible. Could it be then that people could post bond? The way that before you do strip mining, you post bond so that if you leave things in a bad state when you're done strip mining, they cash in the bond to do the cleanup. Could there be a bond system so that if you want really powerful agents, that's what it takes? The way that there's a driver's license for semi-trucks that people that just have licenses for cars can't use to drive the semi-truck. And that feels to me a way of scaling anticipated risks and harms that could be compensated, that would be meaningful to whoever's harmed. Maybe they're not put back exactly where they were. They would have wished they weren't hurt at all. Mm-hmm. But that enough covers it that the system starts to react to those incentives in ways that makes agents safer. That's the happy story for liability. And it says maybe in some circumstances, whoever commissions the agent is responsible. Maybe if they turn out not to have any money, it's okay then to drop down and go after whoever was the white label envelope around the model or the agent. It was some servant that offers it. Okay, they're the ones that were putting it together and they have a bird's eye view of what's being bolted together. All right, maybe if they're not available, maybe it's the model maker. The model maker might have no idea whether the tokens are being generated for a play for something in real life, for later mitigation, and just ideate like crazy. What would be the best way to get a reservation at the table? And one of the things the model spits out is reserve all the tables. Yeah. And later somebody's going to say, no, that's bad. You maybe would want the model to think freely, have that chain of thought.
Yes. Okay. So what I'm, first of all, this was like really useful because you gave me a new dimension of solutions here that kind of are a little bit also non-solutions, just saying, let's set up the kind of the like liability somewhere and see how the system adjusts. But I guess that's how our society works often, like how the incentives work and kind of work their way through the things. Like, by the way, just to not go too much into this rabbit hole, yes, like with software, it's you get the software as is. And there is no, you cannot like sue your OS provider because something was done wrongly with the computer and so on. So it's very interesting where this actually will converge.
It's funny, not being able to sue software providers for buggy software, even if they didn't act in a way a responsible software developer would, is itself a little bit of a legal doctrinal historical accident. It stems from the idea that if we started having people have to pay for their misdeeds that cause economic harm, only economic harm, not physical harm, we're just going to have lawsuits everywhere. The classic example I use in class is somebody drives poorly in front of you. They cause an accident. You're stuck behind them, and you were just going to the store to cash in your lottery ticket for $1 million, and you're going to miss the deadline because of their accident. And putting aside that maybe you should have planned ahead a little more, that's an example of purely economic harm that you can't sue the person in front of for. Most harm from buggy software is economic harm. I couldn't print out the thing I wanted. But if it resulted in physical harm, you have buggy software in some medical device and it causes harm to a patient, you can sue. And so it is possible to imagine either top-down with a statutory adjustment in a relevant state or for a court, which already has carved out some exceptions. There are some forms of purely economic harm that are compensable to say, you know what? These are the kinds of harms that we think would be okay. And that's going to come. I appreciate your puzzlement that it's just this weird trial and error, but no pun intended, trial and error. People just sue over stuff that the doctrine has said you can't successfully sue over. And that sets up, before you even impanel a jury, a fight about whether this even belongs in the courtroom. And the Supreme Court of a jurisdiction, Massachusetts, California, can say, you know what? In this circumstance, let's let that trial go forward and see what happens, kind of thing.
That's, I guess, heartening to some extent. I guess that's how our legal system was forged, by all these small adjustments, small kind of precedents and so on.
I mean, I think to put it back in kind of technical terms, although it's maybe economic terms too, if there are consistent negative externalities from something you've built and that you're selling, why shouldn't you have to internalize those externalities by paying for them when they happen, at which point, in theory, you will achieve the right price for your product and the right level of activity around it. That's the idea. It just gets complicated when it's 8 things had to go wrong for this problem to manifest. There are multiple contributors. How do you allocate among them? That starts to get complicated. But generally, if you're putting something out in the world, classic example from, again, teaching torts is, cool thing, Intercontinental Railroad. By the way, sparks from the train light farmers' fields on fires. Why shouldn't you pay for that? And if you're making enough money off your railroad because it's so valuable, people want to pay to move their goods or move people, that's just a cost of doing business. And if it's purely economic cost rather than physical harm, we think that being able to pay the farmer for the crops they just lost, all right, maybe that works out okay. So could we do the same here, pay the restaurant for all the lost business when all the tables got reserved and nobody turned up? Yeah, that would produce some good incentives for multiple people along the way in whatever produced that, as long as the system is legible to them. These things could be so strange and complicated with what I call systemic intellectual debt. They work magically, but we're not quite sure how. After all, We chartered an agent to figure it out. It appears to have figured it out, except for this one instance where it screwed up. I don't know how to fix it except to tell the agent, do better next time. And maybe that kind of encouragement will help it. And that's the weird thing here, that we are producing voluntarily systems and interactions that are profoundly illegible. And short of just saying, let's just get another AI to understand the system, which you could do or try, do we want to further a world? We're already largely in it, pre-large language models, where the systems work beautifully, but if you change enough of the assumptions at once, they fail in a not graceful way. There's no toilet paper when COVID starts, and who could have foreseen?
Yes. So I think that's a good moment to stop. So I will just ask you one final question.
Yeah.
So you as Jay-Z, like when you think about AI, what it is that you personally look forward the most about AI, or maybe the least about AI in the future it brings?
I think what I look forward to the most is either the kind of stuff the accelerationists are excited about. We're suddenly going to have just a bumper crop of cured diseases. We're going to have systems that really have knowledge at fingertips in a way that, who knew Neal Stephenson truly was writing nonfiction, not fiction, but something like the Diamond Age, where any person in the world can have a tutor that meets them where they're at, including a tutor that helps them connect with other people that are similarly situated or sufficiently diverse that there's so many possibilities for connection in a world where people are denied it and knowledge where people are denied it. That seems great. And that may be less something that I would partake of because I've got books in a library I can get to pretty easily. But that is huge promise. And that depends on the large language models not being smoke and mirrors, which I know there are still folks who think they are. In a qualitative, anecdotal way, they seem pretty good when they're used, tuned, taken with the right grain of salt. What do I worry about the most? That the more agentic and capable we make the systems, somehow the less agentic and capable we become. And I confess, I wasn't a huge fan of the ideas, the claims in, I think it was Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, about Google was making us stupid. Google was opening horizons as far as I was concerned. But I think he was on to something in thinking that people are so not ready for this that just hitting the superficial points may have them not want more, not demand more, and you end up in a kind of WALL-E world. And the last bit I would say on that is, and this is a chapter of this new book, which I don't think should be called We Tried. I think it is.
I love the title.
Yeah. The working title is Gaining Power, Losing Control.
Okay.
And I think it could be useful to have a conversation and a reflection on first and second order preferences. First order preferences are what you want. A McDonald's hamburger. Second order preferences are what you want to want. And that a huge part of living life as a human is not just satisfying what you want in the moment, but setting targets on who you'd like to become and reflectively trying to get there and then seeing it's not what you wanted after all or whatever. But it's growth and development. It's not standing still. And so many of the depredations on the internet side of the ledger have been the superficial satisfaction of first order preferences and the kind of obscure but still quite consistent cultivation of new first order preferences to make for good consumers that are nominally, again, free, but the use of dark patterns really lure people into stuff that they're not subjectively that happy. if you were to take all of that apparatus that developed for internet, for targeted advertising, and that is starting to coalesce around models and systems and AI for more use of tokens, and frame it around second-order preferences and have an ongoing dialogue with the user in the moment even, not every moment, but regularly. Is this what you want? Hey, last week you asked for this and you got it. Just looking back, how do you feel about that? Something like that starting to make people more agentic, more captains of their ships in an era where the boundary between you and everything else is so fuzzy. And I think there's something to autonomy of ourselves, of being able to have enough quiet in our heads to even start to think about what we really want, and is what we really want what we really want. All of that could be facilitated better with AI if it were geared towards that dialogue between first and second order preferences rather than just the superficial libertarian thing. And that ultimately is the way to reconcile the two eras of the rights and the public health.
Thank you. This is a beautiful vision, and I hope that's where we will choose to go so we don't have to write a book, Future of AI, and How to Stop It. This was fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jonathan Citrin, discussing how the current AI trajectory might transform society and what we can do to make this transformation be a positive one. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If so, please share this podcast with your friends, subscribe, and leave feedback in the comments.